You're listening to a Midori House US election special broadcast live from London and New York on the 2nd of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Friday's Midori House US election special. From London, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
And from New York, I'm Aisha Spears.
Just 4 days now, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be analysing the major developments of the last 24 hours, from Mike Bloomberg's endorsement of Obama to the latest job figures.
Adam Bolton, political editor for Sky News, will join us from Washington, D.C. to give us his analysis as the race heads into the final stretch.
Here in London, I'll be joined by Professor Kathleen Burke, who will give us a historical perspective on the 2012 race. And in New York, we'll talk to veteran journalist Maria Hinojosa, founder of the Futura Media Group.
Then we head out on the road again to the swing state of North Carolina and to Chicago, home of Obama's campaign HQ.
And talking of swing states, we'll hear part three of Sasha Eisenberg's guide. Today, it's Colorado and Nevada.
Well, it's a state that is in transition demographically, a large Latino population. That one of the reasons that the Democrats think that the sort of Rocky Mountain West is the next part of the country that they can slowly swing over to their column.
We'll also be exploring Australia's love affair with Obama and asking how this relationship has evolved since 2008, our opinions turning down under 4 years later.
Politics is the one American sport that Australians can understand. We don't understand gridiron, but we can understand candidate A versus candidate B.
And we'll also have a little look at the latest polls. So lots coming up right here on our Midori House US election special, live from London and New York on Monocle 24.
But first, over to London to get the latest news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
The number of people killed by Hurricane Sandy is now over 170. Two new deaths were recorded in Haiti, bringing the total for the country to 54. In the United States, with the toll there nearly 100, people in states like New York and New Jersey are suffering severely from power shortages. Jason Nordyke showed reporters the damage the flood had done to his apartment.
Monday, the water was coming through. About first, before we left, the water was about this high. So it was time to leave. We all packed our stuff and locked the house and we left. And then the next day, and later on the next day, we walked in and the water was about this high, about 5'4" here, and all the way to the basement, so you can say about 10 feet of water.
Citizens of Poktor Township in Burma's Rakhine State have toured what's left of some Rohingya villages today in an area nearly 600 miles northwest of the commercial capital of Yangon. The Muslim Rohingyas said their homes were burnt down a week ago by Buddhist Rakhines in a new outbreak of violence between the two groups. A senior Israeli official has said today that Egypt's revolution has given birth to an Islamist dictatorship. The remarks by Amos Gilad, a top aide to the defense minister Ehud Barak, were some of the starkest comments yet about the rise to prominence of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and the accession to power of President Mohamed Morsi. Coffee shop owners in Amsterdam, like Joachim Hels, expressed relief today at the announcement by the city's mayor that all tourists would still be welcome in the Dutch capital's famous cannabis camp. Phase.
What we saw in the south of Holland, where the witpas was introduced, is that you see a big uprise of the black market. There's no control over the quality of the soft drugs, and also no control over the age that people buy the soft drugs, which is the case in the coffee shops. So now we can make sure that the coffee shops can take the responsibility to make sure that people can use the soft drugs in a safe environment.
US employers stepped up hiring in October and the jobless rate ticked higher as more workers restarted job hunts, a hopeful sign for a lackluster economy that had been a drag on President Barack Obama's re-election chances. The employment data was the last major report card on the economy before Tuesday's presidential election. President Obama is today campaigning in the swing state of Ohio.
In 2008, we were in the middle of two wars and the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Today, our businesses have created nearly 5.5 million new jobs. And this morning, we learned that companies hired more workers in October than at any time in the last 8 months.
And finally, with that general election in just 4 days' time and President Obama and his Republican challenger Mitt Romney currently neck and neck, each on 49%, It's amazing what companies will offer to get the American vote. A yoga studio in Washington, D.C. has said it will give free classes to anyone who casts his or her ballot. Other marketing gimmicks include free pizza for life from Pizza Hut, fresh coffee in blue Barack Obama or red Mitt Romney cups from 7-Eleven, and, would you believe it, free flights out of the country on JetBlue for voters whose presidential favourite ends up losing. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. That sounds like it might be a rather expensive promise for JetBlue to keep, but we'll see. It's 18.05 here in London, 14.05 on the East Coast. You're listening to a Midori House US election special live from London and New York on Monocle 24. Welcome, one and all, to the third Midori House US election special. Aisha, how are you doing in New York?
I'm well, Steve. How are you in London with electricity and hot water and all those wonderful things of civilization?
Indeed, indeed. Well, I'm going to be leaving the cozy confines of London to head to New York tomorrow morning to join you. What sort of city am I going to be flying into?
It depends where you're going to be in Manhattan. Actually, I know where you're going to be. You're going to be uptown, so you're going to be okay.
You've got electricity.
But I know that the rest of New York is very excited that alongside power, electricity and heat, this weekend we might have Steve Bloomfield also in town, which is a huge thing to herald. So I think the red carpet is out. There's also the marathon, which is happening on Sunday. A little bit of a touchy subject for some people because it traditionally starts in Staten Island, which has been very, very badly hit by Superstorm Sandy. But one thing I did notice last night, which I was really happy about, walking home from the studio, getting below 26th Street and getting into the dark zone, basically, all of the small independently owned businesses had candles out. They were there for their neighborhoods. They were serving up whatever they could find, whatever they could healthily cook. And the bars were trying to be open. And all the chain stores, the Duane Reade's, the Staples, the CVS's, they were closed because clearly there was some sort of remit from top saying you can't open for legal reasons. But all the neighborhood shops were open. So it's really a time to support your neighborhood grocery or neighborhood restaurant right now.
That's quite interesting to hear. Let's talk about the marathon briefly. As you mentioned there's been some talk about whether it should really go ahead. You've had the borough president of Manhattan, Scott Stringer, today saying he thought it should be postponed. Do you think it is going to go ahead?
I mean, it's going ahead. That's the latest news. It is going to go ahead. It's a touchy subject, obviously. A lot of people will be donating money to recovery from Superstorm Sandy, which is a politically correct move. Of course, there are a lot of people flying in and for the marathon. So I think that in some ways, logistically, they have to have it happen. But it's insensitive, I think, for some people to see cleanup crews cleaning up streets for the marathon while they should be devoting their time to helping people in the Rockaways or in Staten Island in areas that have been devastated by the storm.
Before you introduce your first guest that you have with you there in New York, a quick word about Mayor Mike Bloomberg. The minute we came off air last night, he endorsed Barack Obama. 24 hours on or 23 hours on, what impact do you think that's had so far?
I'm not sure anyone here is really caring too much about who's endorsing who right now until they have their lives back to normal. It's not hugely surprising, although he had said that he didn't want to endorse anyone. What it does raise is the issue of climate change and how important environmental issues will be for American politics over the next few decades. It's something which I hope we can talk about later on today. But I mean, I'm glad he's endorsed him, but it does make sense. And it's interesting how much love Obama is getting at the moment from a lot of people on this side of the country.
Aisha Tursi, who you have in the studio with you today.
Very happy today to be joined by Maria Hinojosa, founder of the Futura Media Group and an Emmy Award winning journalist. And Maria, the first thing I wanted to talk to you about is you covered Hurricane Katrina. And this is a very, very different situation, of course. But there seem to be some on the right who are trying to paint this, in a sense, as Obama's Katrina, that they're trying to rally up anyone they can who's saying you're focusing on Manhattan, you're not focusing on the outer boroughs. Why are you rescuing the real estate rich area of the city? How do you see that playing out? What do you think the political impact of this storm will be?
I think that the immediate, and first of all, it's great to be with you. And hello, Steve, down in London,
Marie.
Where it is. and we're fine here. Everybody is really awaiting your arrival, so you'll be fine. The red carpet is out. I think that the immediate reaction from most people is going to say, you know what, this is not a time to be playing politics. And comparing Katrina to Sandy, are you kidding? This is a time when people are, in my case, for example, I was stranded in Texas for a couple of days, but my family in Harlem was fine. So I'm feeling a bit of survivor guilt. Our office has been closed because all of my staff is in Brooklyn, so they can't make it into the city. But this is not a time when people are just kind of, thinking about what happened in Katrina and the horrors there. I think if anything, people are thinking, thank God nothing as horrible as Katrina happened here. And I think you're right, frankly, Aisha, that it's more a sentiment of when you've got Chris Christie, a very outspoken Republican governor of nearby New Jersey, basically using, some pretty tough language there to say, in his words, I don't give a damn about the election right now. That's not what this is about. That's the sentiment of most people. So for anyone in the Republican Party or any of their cohorts or supporters to be bringing this up in some kind of comparison, I think is very dangerous at this precise moment.
Maria, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about immigration, which has sort of come up a little bit during the campaign, but not hugely. But on the moments it has, Romney, certainly during the primary campaign, was very strong, is one way of putting it, very conservative on this. Do you think that's really harmed him with the Latino and Latina voters?
You know what? What you have to do is you have to start from numbers, Steve. Right now, the latest statistics that we have are that one in four Latinos in the United States, one in four, knows someone who has been detained or deported. And that under the Obama administration, detentions and deportations are at an all-time high. Never in the history of the United States have we seen this many deportations in this short a period of time. It's an extraordinary moment. So that's kind of on the Democratic side, right? Because this is President Obama who oversaw this. And he had made promises that immigration was going to be on the top of his list to resolve. On the other hand, throughout the Republican primary season and then leading up to candidate Romney, what you saw was this theater of trying to be even more conservative than the next Republican candidate on the issue of immigration, except for Newt Gingrich and Huntsman, frankly. But the rest were very, very clearly making statements that were anti-immigrant, read anti-Latino. So many Latino voters, frankly, feel like they're in something of a pickle, if you will. I can tell you that my greatest concern has been that with Latino voters, of course, Latinos being the demographic that is growing the fastest in our country. And so we should all care what happens with their democratic participation and expression because they are the futuro of this country. My concern was that many Latino voters would just say, I'm done. I'm so upset. President Obama didn't resolve this. Romney is saying self-deportation or is mixing things up. I'm confused. You know, now the president has created a deferred action for young people who didn't come here by choice without papers. It's a confusing time. And my concern was that many Latinos would just simply throw their hands up. Well, I have to say that some good news is that having just returned from Texas, and where I've been, I was just there earlier this week, and I ask everyone who I meet who's Latino who they're voting for and everything. I think that you are in fact going to have Latinos coming to the polls, that they are in fact understanding what's at play here, and that this could in fact be a very, very big loss for the Republican Party because of the fact that they're this mixed message on immigration. So I think this could in fact be a very big turning point for the Republican Party vis-a-vis this electoral vote.
Maria, thank you very much. I want to bring in our guest here in London. Very pleased to be joined by Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London and expert on American history and Anglo-American relations. Kathy, welcome back to Monocle 24.
Pleasure to be here.
When you look at this election in a historical perspective, are there any other previous elections where you can draw comparisons between what's happening right now and what happened then?
Well, I mean, it was 2008 was the game changer, obviously, for reasons that do not require explanation. I think the closest comparison I can think of is the election of 1960 between Kennedy and Nixon. Kennedy was subsequently the first Catholic president, so he broke through a barrier in the same way that Obama did, although not in the same intense manner, of course. But it was also an extremely close election that turned on a few votes, as it were, in Chicago. Now, the interesting comparison there is that this election could very well turn on a few votes here or there. And what's notable is that both parties are going to send out lots of poll watchers.
And lots of lawyers.
Exactly. But, I mean, what does that remind you of? Does it remind you of, Egypt, you know, or Russia, where, you know, they're international poll watchers, as it were? It's interesting that the United States has treated itself in this sense just as though they were treating another developing country.
And is that because you think that people don't have faith in the voting system as much as they should have, or is that because it's just a sort of a good fail-safe?
Well, I suspect there's a bit of both. You don't mobilize that many people and that much money if you think it's just going to be the odd headline. People looked at what happened in Florida. Many didn't trust it, and they decided it's not going to happen again. And both parties have put aside a substantial amount of money to finance that whole exercise.
Kathleen Burke, thank you very much indeed. We'll be speaking to both you and Maria in New York several times throughout this show. You're listening to Midori House US election special here on Monocle 24. After this short break, we'll be hearing the latest from Washington, Chicago and the swing state of North Carolina. Stay with us.
Be our guest and come spend the weekend with Monocle 24. We kick off on Saturday with the Weekend Edition, a smart, relaxing selection of music, news headlines and great conversation.
There's real excitement there, you know, and it's sort of like, wow, I don't really understand what they're doing, but I love the sound of it.
Then join us for our brand new show, The Stack, celebrating the world of print media, from chunky Korean glossies to fine-tuned Brazilian newspapers. Hosted by Tyler Brulé, each week we pull in guest reviewers to crack open spines and thumb through inky pages to reveal why there's more to journalism than going digital.
The publication you have in your hand is all about women across the Middle East. The one in your hand is about skiing in Morocco. They have one about the Saudi pavilion in the Osaka Expo. So it was very progressive.
Later, this Saturday review casts a critical eye over the week's literature, music, TV, cinema and the arts and delivers some fun, fast-paced conversation too.
It's a bit of a riot, actually. They just boiled the crayfish in water.
That sounds like a riot so far.
On Sunday, stay over for the Monocle Weekly, our longest-running radio show that brings our editors face-to-face with everyone from academics to war correspondents, historians to social commentators, and serves up some fine music too.
I sort of came to Brazilian music quite late. Yeah, it's something that I'm still discovering.
And don't miss The Curator, our one-hour survey of the week's highlights on Monocle 24. That's the new weekend lineup on Monocle 24. This is the Midori House election special with Steve Bloomfield and Aisha Spears.
It is indeed, and it's 18:18 here in London, 14:18 in New York City. In a moment, we'll be heading around the country to check in with correspondents in Chicago and North Carolina. But first, let us cross to Washington, D.C. to speak to Adam Bolton, a political editor for Sky News. Adam, welcome to Midori House. We're now 4 days away. We've had, over the last 24 hours, Mayor Bloomberg coming out in favor of Obama. We've had these job figures. Are either of those things that have happened in the last 24 hours anything approaching game changers for you?
Well, they're certainly not bad news for Barack Obama's campaign. A lot of talk about independence, and Barack Obama's had the endorsement of not just Mayor Bloomberg, but also Colin Powell, and he's running TV ads to that effect. And independence in the close states are going to be very important. As far as the jobs figures are concerned, again, so often with statistics, you can present this two ways, but it does show that the United States is undergoing an economic recovery and that appears to be speeding up. But Republicans would say, on the other hand, it's not speeding up fast enough. And with unemployment at 7.9%, it's a long way short of what Barack Obama promised.
Adam, it seems that it does look like a lot of good news for the Obama camp, and Romney's turned his attention to Pennsylvania in a new way. Why do you think this is? Is that an act of desperation?
Well, they appear in the campaign fairly late on to be opening up a new front. They've said they're going to go to Pennsylvania. They're also talking about Michigan and Minnesota, all states where it had been felt that Barack Obama was pretty strong. And indeed, David Axelrod has said he will shave off his moustache if Obama loses any of those. But what the Republicans are trying to say at the moment is that the opinion polls have got it all wrong. They overrepresent the strength of the Democratic vote in the country. And by going to Pennsylvania on Sunday for a big rally, Romney is trying to send out the message that he's more viable in more states than people think. The precedent, of course, is the last election when John McCain did something very similar, but Barack Obama went on to win Pennsylvania in the election.
Adam, I want to talk about how you're covering this, because, I mean, you're covering it for a UK audience and also an international audience, so less so for a US audience. We were speaking with Matt Fry from Channel 4 News a few days ago, who said that, you know, the big challenge was trying to explain to people, particularly in Europe, why many Americans like Mitt Romney. Do you sympathise with that view, that it's sometimes difficult to get people on this side of the Atlantic to really understand why the Republicans are still doing pretty well?
Yeah, I certainly think you have to try and get across that it's a very different environment, because we know even amongst conservative supporters in Britain, I think more than 80% of them want to see Barack Obama re-elected, which clearly is not the picture here. I think the way one tries to do it is by reporting from as many places as possible, and certainly on Sky News we've got correspondents in a dozen of locations, dozens of states in the next few days. And you have to try and present the arguments which are being made and the context in which they are coming across as clearly as you possibly can. I mean, the fact of the matter is, one of the big mistakes we always make in reporting America to foreign audiences is we do concentrate very heavily on the presidency. Any American will tell you that the Congress, the Senate, the House of Representatives, and of course the Supreme Court are at least as powerful as the president in deciding what actually happens in this country.
Adam Bolton, thank you very much, political editor for Sky News. Now, North Carolina is one of the few swing states which most pollsters still believe is genuinely up in the air. Bill Clinton is there tomorrow and Michelle Obama is due in town on Monday, suggesting that the Obama camp are far from confident that their state's 15 electoral college votes will end up in the blue column. Dave DeWitt from WUNC is in Chapel Hill. Dave, thank you very much for joining us. So tell me a little bit about why President Clinton and Michelle Obama are in town.
Well, they're here to try to convince people that may still be undecided, if those votes are actually out there, to obviously vote for the president. Now, North Carolina only went very slightly for President Obama in 2008, 14,000 votes total. That's just 0.3% of a percentage point. Mitt Romney and his campaign have believed that North Carolina has been in their column pretty much since he won the nomination, but the polls have tightened here in the last couple of weeks, and the Obama campaign clearly believes it's a player here and can win this state, but they don't view North Carolina maybe as vital to their path to 270 electoral votes as, say, Ohio or even Pennsylvania, so that's why the president himself isn't coming or hasn't been here since the Democratic National Convention.
On the congressional front, it looks like Republicans are going to do pretty well in North Carolina. What does that tell us about the way the state is developing politically?
Well, North Carolina is a very interesting state politically. It's got more of a progressive influence than most southern states in North Carolina. Democrats have dominated politics here really since Reconstruction after the Civil War. So Republican gains have been significant in recent years, and as you mentioned, that's going to really manifest itself in the congressional seats. North Carolina has 13 seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. Democrats have held a majority of those seats for more than a century, but Republicans will definitely pick up a majority of maybe as many as 10 of those 13 seats when voting occurs on Tuesday. So this will be a very red state, except for on the presidential level, oddly enough, And that, as you mentioned, is really a toss-up.
It is indeed. Dave DeWitt from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24. Now to Chicago, Illinois, a state that Obama has absolutely no chance of losing at all. There is a rather interesting congressional race, though, and we'll come on to that in a moment. But Allison Cuddy, a reporter for WBEC, joins us now. So Chicago is Obama's hometown. How much do residents there really care about that?
They care significantly about that. I mean, I think that, you know, as you said, there's no chance that the president is going to lose his home state or his home city. But the big difference this time around is that in 2008, people felt they were voting for something. That's not the case anymore. Now they're either holding the line or holding their nose or, in some cases, jumping ship. So the energy, the excitement, all of that is kind of gone.
Allison, let's talk about the people who are jumping ship. Who's jumping ship, and what, and how are the Republicans in Chicago managing to capture these people?
In the Republicans in the congressional districts, that's where things get really exciting. I think that in some cases, people who turned out for the president in 2008, who might not have voted Democratic but voted because of that energy and excitement, the idea of a new candidate, are not going to vote now. But it's these congressional races where things have gotten a bit more exciting. I mean, this is the land of Lincoln, and there's a very typical kind of Illinois Republican, fiscally conservative, socially moderate, one who might look like a Democrat here. That's not the case anymore. The last few electoral cycles have ushered in a new kind of Republican. They tend more, including members of the Tea Party, but they tend to be more like the kind of extremes you're seeing at the national level on both sides, you know, both the right and the left. So there are some very tight races here at the congressional level, and that's fascinating because that's where the Republicans could, you know, gain speed at the national level in the House.
Allison, let's just talk briefly about one of those races, Jesse Jackson Jr., who doesn't really appear to be there.
No, this is a fascinating story, kind of both a political tragedy and in some ways a political farce. This is a Southside Democrat from the well-known political family, the Jacksons, his father, Reverend Jesse Jackson. He left Congress in June 10th, and hasn't had a campaign event or a public appearance since then. He has representatives, including his wife, including his father, have said that he's suffering from bipolar disorder and some gastrointestinal issues related to bypass surgery he had. So he's doing nothing. He's not campaigning whatsoever. That said, because of the fact that the Democrats have such a stronghold here in the state, he's going to likely win re-election. There is a Republican running against him. An independent are challenging him for the seat, but it's very, very unlikely that he's going to lose it.
Allison Cuddy from WBEC in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us. Kathy Burt, listening to that, I mean, is there, you know, we're getting a bit of a feel for what's going on all over the country. It looks pretty good for Obama, doesn't it? When you look at those sort of big sweeping issues, from the endorsements, from the jobs figures, from Chris Christie saying such lovely things about him. You'd be pretty happy if you're in his camp right now, wouldn't you?
Well, I think so. I mean, the nationwide polls seem to have him and Romney more or less matched 49% each. But as you obviously point out, if you look at the states where it matters, where things might actually move out of concrete, he has anywhere from 1 to 3% lead. I mean, that's obviously within error, statistical error. But nevertheless, yes, I think that he doesn't have the big momentum, but he has a small momentum. And at this point, that's all that's really necessary. Yes, I think I would be happy. I think I would be anxious, but I think I would be a dawning happiness.
Maria, I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, you mentioned as a fact that we all know that the Latino vote and the Latino population is going to grow to become the most influential, really, in the U.S. How do you see that playing out following the election of the first non-white president of the United States and the kind of consolidation of race and also location within the U.S. and how that will affect how politics gets played out?
Well, it's actually really interesting. This is another, I mean, one of the, I grew up actually on the south side of Chicago. Okay. My parents still live in the neighborhood of High Park, which is where President Obama used to live before he moved to the Capitol. So it is a very mixed community. It's very Latino and very African-American and mixed all across the board. But this particular relationship between African-Americans and Latinos is very, very, very important to me. And one of my greater concerns, again, in terms of Latinos and their kind of sense of participation in this democracy is precisely that. This sentiment of, wait a second, I voted for a black man and he didn't deliver in terms of the promises that he made regarding immigration. That's a problem. But interestingly, again, from what I'm getting on the ground, that's not what I'm hearing. There may have been that sentiment, but whatever it is, it seems to me that what Latinos are hearing is if Obama is reelected, perhaps there can be more of a push to get him to deliver now in his second term. But if Romney is elected, it could spell a catastrophe. Completely unresolved. Again, this notion of self-deportation, this notion of Arizona laws, SB 1070 being okay and acceptable. So this may, as Kathleen was saying, it may be just the little oomph that he needs, the president, that being. But the real loss is that neither one of these candidates has captured the fire of a potential Latino vote in a huge way, which I think the president did have last time around. And given what I say is, frankly, a lack of leadership and a lack of his people understanding what this Latino power block could be for him and for the Democratic Party, this is where it is a big loss, I think.
Maria, thank you very much indeed. Kathy also will be speaking to you both of you again very shortly. This is a Midori House US election special on Monocle 24.
Van uit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
Way you London. This is Monocle 24.
From London. This is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London, Europe.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll be asking what Australians are making of the race to the White House. We'll talk polls with Julia Clark from Ipsos, and we'll have today's installment of our Swing States Guide. This time, we're off to Colorado and Nevada.
Romney's sort of fiscal conservatism plays well there. At the same time, Democrats have won recent elections for the Senate by talking a lot about abortion and trying to make the kind of religious conservative, social conservative end of the Republican Party just scary for folks in Colorado.
But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. The number of people killed by Hurricane Sandy is now over 170. Two new deaths were recorded in Haiti, bringing the total for the country to 54. In the US, with a total there of nearly 100, people in states like New York and New Jersey are suffering severely from power shortages. Citizens in Burma's Rakhine State have toured what's left of some Rohingya villages today in an area nearly 600 miles northwest of the capital, Yangon. The Muslim Rohingyas said their homes were burnt down a week ago by Buddhist Rakhines in a new outbreak of violence between the two groups. A senior Israeli official has said today that Egypt's revolution had given birth to an Islamist dictatorship. The remarks by Amos Gilad, a top aide to the defence minister Ehud Barak, were some of the starkest comments yet about the rise to prominence of the Muslim Brotherhood. There was good news for Barack Obama today, with 117,000 new jobs added in October. The employment data was the last major report card on the economy before Tuesday's general election. And finally, coffee shop owners in Amsterdam expressed relief and delight today at the announcement by the city's mayor that all tourists would still be welcome in the Dutch capital's famous cannabis cafes. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. This is a Midori House special on Monocle 23, but it is day three of our US election specials. I'm Steve Bloomfield, very much live in London.
And live in New York, I'm Aisha Spears. Every day on our election specials, we're visiting a different place around the world to hear what the election means in that corner of the globe. Today, we're off down under to Sydney.
Australians' love affair with Barack Obama started with his historic victory in 2008, and their feelings for the US president are even stronger now as he battles for a second term. So why hasn't Obama's declining popularity at home affected the Obama mania down under? And will the increased US military presence in the region impact on this? From Sydney, Claire Aird reports.
If Australians were choosing America's next president, there'd be no race for the White House. Barack Obama would be swept back into power with a resounding victory. Polls consistently show that around 75% of the nation prefers the current commander-in-chief to his Republican rival Mitt Romney. Sydney University student James Farquharson is one of the majority. He's been intently watching the third presidential debate with his peers.
Thank you to Lynn University for welcoming us here. And Mr. President, it's good to be with you again. We were together.
From an Australian perspective, I think Barack Obama has had the best approach in terms of managing the ANZUS alliance and has kept Australian interests closer to heart. And I think he's a continuation of that policy will be for the long-term benefit of Australian national security and in terms of our broader relationship with the United States. You know, being the first African-American president, that's a humongous deal, and the United States is such a fundamentally important country in the world that it's really hard to ignore its electoral cycle.
Planet America, it's the greatest show on Earth. The battle for the president...
Politics is the one American sport that Australians can understand. We don't understand gridiron, but we can understand candidate A versus candidate B.
John Barron is the co-host of Planet America on Australia's public broadcaster, the ABC. The weekly discussion show was launched this year in response to public interest in the 2008 US election campaign.
When you had the first African-American candidate, the first viable female candidate, the first Latino candidate, as well as Mitt Romney, the first modern Republican Mormon candidate. So from that point of view, people could buy into the historical side of the election. So to an extent this year, there's a sense of we want to see how that story plays out. How does Barack Obama, this historic first black president in the White House, how does that end?
John Barron says that one reason why so many Australians want to see Barack Obama return to office is because he represents their liberal views.
I think it's fair to say that Australia sits to the left of the United States. The centre of gravity in the United States is generally more conservative. It doesn't necessarily mean that if there is a conservative government in the United States and a progressive government in Australia that the alliance is any weaker. In the 1980s. A Labor Party Prime Minister in Bob Hawke in Australia was very close to the administration of Ronald Reagan, who was about as conservative as Republicans get. The enduring ties between our countries and the cultural links as well kind of exist beyond party politics. There is a bipartisan commitment to the Australia-US relationship.
The majority of Australians value the country's security alliance with the United States. But these warm feelings toward America have been tested at times by the White House's decisions to go to war.
Australians tend to feel close to Americans, but we do worry. When George W. Bush was president, Australians were concerned that because our foreign policy has been effectively linked to the United States for 70 years now, that if we were following America into every war they get involved with, which we've tended to do since the Second World War, that might be leading us astray.
Aussies and Americans like you have stood together since World War I.
In April, 200 American troops landed in Darwin on the country's north coast for joint military and training exercises. That number will increase to 2,500 soldiers by 2017. This military commitment was made by Barack Obama during his visit to Australia last year. The president declared the US would take an expanded role in shaping the Asia-Pacific region. In response, China warned of Australia getting caught in the crossfire.
I guess one of the most important issues that are affecting Australians' thinking in this region is the US approach to China.
Dr. Bates Gill is the head of the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney.
It sparked quite a major debate here in Australia about how Australia needs to position itself between its longtime traditional ally, the United States on the one hand, versus its deepening economic relationship with the major economic power, China. And this has caused a lot of contention here in Australia about how to strike that balance.
Most recently, in the third presidential debate, both Barack Obama and his challenger Mitt Romney vowed to be firm on China. Mr. Romney accused the Asian superpower of stealing America's intellectual property.
We have to say to our friends in China, look, you guys are playing aggressively, we understand it, but this can't keep on going. You can't keep on holding down the value of your currency, stealing our intellectual property, counterfeiting our products.
Well, if we believe that everything Governor Romney has said about China will actually come true when he becomes president, then that would be a quite different approach. It would probably relate in end up in a more contentious and tension-filled relationship with China. And between China and the United States, which I think would be bad for Australia.
But like many analysts, Dr. Bates-Gill has played down Mitt Romney's words as more campaign rhetoric than future policy.
These two candidates really don't differ all that much on their foreign policy agendas. Both, I would say, by and large, are positive for Australian interests in the Asia-Pacific region. It's on the economy where there are real differences. And depending on how you judge these policies is how you're going to think they might unfold for Australia, because a strong American economy clearly is the best outcome for Australia.
And that was Dr. Bates-Gill from the University of Sydney, ending that report there by Claire Aid. And we'll be hearing more from around the world throughout our election specials. I believe we might even be off to Kenya on Monday. I'm still joined in the studio here in London by Dr. Kathleen Burke, a Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and expert on American history and Anglo-American relations.
And in New York, I'm here with Maria Hinojosa, founder of the Futura Media Group and a veteran journalist of many, many different types of stories.
Kathy, I want to start with you. When you look at what America's relationship with Britain, this, let's not use the phrase special relationship, because only Brits with an inferior sense of their own self-worth use that phrase. It's very easy to look at it and think, oh, well, we won't like President Mitt Romney because he came here and he criticised our Olympics. And as has been mentioned before, many conservatives in the UK would far rather President Obama. Is that true?
It's quite clear that Romney's heart doesn't beat faster when he looks across at Britain. But of course, neither does Barack Obama's, as far as one can tell. Obviously, there is a close relationship in terms of military power and intelligence and people working together. But fundamentally, I think their foreign policies, overall strategic foreign policies, are diverging a bit. When Europe was important, when Europe was in danger, the United States worked very closely with Britain. But Europe's not a problem anymore. And there's not going to be a war in the middle of Europe. And what that means is that America can look elsewhere to where it sees its danger and American interest, American attention, and American military power is moving to the Pacific, which means as that Europe has to more or less take care not only of Europe, but perhaps the Middle East a little bit more than they have done, and North Africa. So what I'm trying to say is there's going to be a continuing foreign policy relationship, but I don't think it's going to be as hymns across the sea and as it used to be.
Kathy, we heard earlier from Adam Bolton that a lot of the foreign press neglect to cover the issue of congressional races here, the issue of the Senate. Do you think that's because there's a lack of understanding for the complexities of the American political system? Do you think it's because the foreign press perhaps don't care and they just would like to look at who's in the White House?
Well, I think both of them are incredibly important. The problem is when you have a British prime minister who has such, in American terms, an autocratic control over the legislative process, well, we can think that's for what it's worth, but you know what I mean. They don't understand that Obama can't do what he wants to do. And so attention is paid there, seeing to what extent he can do this or can do that. And if he can't, there's something wrong with him. They don't look at the House of Representatives then as the other side because they do not realize just how important it is. The trouble is the two political cultures can look a bit alike, but we all know, least in these two studios, how very, very different they are. But you can imagine the Sun coming up with, look at the races in Michigan. You know, what you need to look at is this 425,000 people and how they're going to vote. I can't see it somehow. And that's a shame, because you're quite right. That's at this point, that's where the power lies, not in the presidency, because the president can propose, but the House of Representatives, which controls the money, disposes.
Maria, let's turn to the foreign policy debate, which included actually quite a lot of stuff on domestic policy. Little old Mali in North Africa got two mentions by Mitt Romney, which is two more than most countries in Latin America. Were you surprised that Latin America didn't come up a bit more in those debates?
I'm surprised only in the sense that, again, what a lost opportunity. I mean, part of what's historically been seen is this very strange relationship between North and South in terms of the Americas. This is Brazil, for example, Chile, Argentina. You know, these are economies are pretty much on the uptick at this point, and it's a lost opportunity for the American economy to not understand how close to in proximity we are with the South and the possible economic ventures that that could exist there. Mexico, again, its economy is growing, was not even mentioned in the debates, rarely even discussed. Cuba, an unresolved issue, again, a place where I think that if President Obama wanted to take a position of leadership, which frankly is what I think this electorate would like to see more of, to get that enthusiasm back, he could be saying things about Cuba, a place where, you know, again, the American economy has no relationship. What a lost opportunity. So I think that a lot of people would just appreciate more clarity and leadership from both parties and from both of these candidates in terms of the South, their immediate South in Latin America.
Maria, thank you very much. You're listening to a US election special of Midori House, live from London and New York, 1846 here in London, 1446 in New York. We'll be right back after this with our guide to the swing states. Stay tuned.
Wherever you're going this autumn, and whether it's for work or play, let Monocle's editors be your travel companions. We've just refreshed and revised our team's guides to the world's top business cities and resorts, so you can have our 25/25 travel guide series in the palm of your hand with the Monocle app available from iTunes, or download free guides from monocle.com. From São Paulo to New York, Capri to St. Barts, we can show you where to long lunch or go for your morning run. Just go to the iTunes App Store and download the Monocle app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
This is the Midori House election special with Steve Bloomfield and Aisha Spears.
It is indeed. And it's that time of the show again when we turn to our political guru, otherwise known as our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, for his guide to the swing states. Part three is Colorado and Nevada.
I'm Sasha Eisenberg, and here's Monocle's guide to the swing states.
Sasha, let's turn our attention to Colorado. When you look at the polls in this state, they've been incredibly close for a very long time. Romney up a little bit, then Obama up a little bit. Why is it a state that's so close to call?
Well, it's a state that is in transition demographically, a large Latino population, that one of the reasons that the Democrats think that the sort of Rocky Mountain West is the next part of the country that they can slowly swing over to their column. Obama won it in 2008. Very few Democrats had Clinton had won it once, but it had been Republican turf for a while. Very socially liberal. There's a sort of libertarian sensibility that exists a lot on the left. And so I think that you see, especially sort of upscale white voters, very cross-pressured. I think that Romney's sort of fiscal conservatism plays well there. At the same time, Democrats have won recent elections for the Senate by talking a lot about abortion and trying to make the kind of religious conservative, social conservative end of the Republican Party just scary for folks in Colorado. And so it is a place where that sort of Democratic war on women type messaging will probably be used most readily, focused on especially suburban women in the Denver suburbs who are relatively upscale. But the Democrats think that if they start talking about some of these Republican Senate candidates who've been talking about rape or restrictions on Planned Parenthood, that they can basically scare folks from voting Republican for president.
And is that a view that the Republicans share? I mean, when you look at what the Romney campaign is putting out in Colorado, are we seeing more of the moderate Mitt rather than the severely conservative Mitt?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a whole lot of moderate Mitt over the last month on basically everything, blurring the distinctions on domestic policy, sort of dialing down his views on immigration, which in the primary were pretty fierce, and then obviously on foreign policy in the last debate, trying to obscure many of the differences. And Colorado is the type of state where Romney's path to victory probably is best sustained by looking as much like Obama on the issues as possible, but trying to offer some sort of optimistic change, a new direction type of sensibility.
Let's look at Nevada now. I mean, when you look at it on a map, it's one spot of blue surrounded by a sea of red. Why is that?
This is a place where Democratic machinery still exists. It's, you know, in many new states, the old sort of Democratic machine of party bosses in the big city and unions don't really exist because a lot of the sort of growing southern states don't have big union, labor union presence. Las Vegas is a lot different because every one of those hotels, casinos on the strip is unionized and they have a large workforce of largely Latino blue collar workers who are cleaning rooms and working in kitchens. And they are organized in a union called Culinary. It represents most of the casino workers and they are probably the most politically effective union in the state. Harry Reid, who's the Senate Majority Leader, used them to great effect to mobilize votes in 2010. And I would hear stories from people who are out there who are just sort of mesmerized at the vans that would line up outside these casinos on the strip and just drive people to early vote locations every hour for weeks. And so it is a place, you know, it has a large Mormon population, which I think cheers Romney. It's a place where there he spent a lot of time in Utah, which is nearby. And I think that there's a sense among the Romney campaign that there should be some sort of cultural connection that he has to the voters in Nevada. But then again, it's a place where Democrats really just have like perfected the art of squeezing out their voters, and the influence of labor unions is a small part of that.
That was Sasha Eisenberg talking to Steve in part three of our guide to the swing states. On Monday, we'll be talking Wisconsin and Michigan. Maria, you just came back from Colorado, if I understand correctly. Tell me what you think about the issue of voting there.
I can tell you that I felt a lot of enthusiasm. You know, when I was at the airport, I was asking people, so what does it feel like to be, you know, part of a state that could make history? And there was a lot of enthusiasm. Again, Latino young workers that I met in the airport, talking to them, they were all like, yes, we're voting. And then I'd tell you, so who are you voting for? And then they'd kind of say, well, Obama. But it wasn't like if they were rah-rah, you know, Obama, but yes, Obama. Here's what I think people need to think about a state like Colorado. It is a much more progressive than we might imagine. It is, one of the television commercials that was playing on and on and on when I was there is a former police chief who was talking about, you know, is it right to spend police time tracking down buyers and sellers of marijuana? No. He was like, of course, this is a waste of time. It doesn't do anything. These are nonviolent. You know, let's put our resources to where they need to be. So again, a kind of progressive mentality. And I think that Colorado is enjoying the fact that it's getting more of a higher profile and as a real swing state. So I think there's enthusiasm there. And I think that it could be leaning towards President Obama.
And moving over to Nevada, we've seen in previous years, there's been quite an influence of immigration laws in Arizona that are affecting how people think in Nevada. How important do you think those are now?
Oh, very much so. I think that the question about a place like Nevada, like Colorado, is all about turnout. It's all about turnout. It's all about that machine. It's all about that enthusiasm. And that's what we don't know. I can tell you now that surprisingly, one of the things that I've heard over and over, even getting close to the election, is let's not forget Florida. Let's not forget counting chads. Let's assume that it doesn't have to go that way. But I still think that there is. It is very, very close. And people are a little worried about this question of turnout and who, in fact, will get a chance to vote or not.
Kathy, back in 2004, just after the election there was a map that was put together showing the red states and the blue states, and included Canada as well, and was described as the United States of Canada and Jesus Land, being all the red states in between. There's a little less of that now. You've got certain blue states amongst the red. Do you feel that, you know, we're still having a blue America and a red America, or has that started to change a bit?
Well, I'm Sorry, I'm afraid I go for your first point. I mean, if you look back over the, ever since the founding fathers, there has always been distrust between the rural areas and the urban areas. If you look at, it's Albany, New York, it's Springfield, Illinois, it's Sacramento, California. It's not the big states, the big cities, which are the capitals of all these states. If you look at this red and blue map that you've mentioned, it's the Pacific Coast and the eastern seaboard, northeastern seaboard. Those are the Democratic heartlands. Now, and Illinois stuck in the middle, of course, with Chicago. But and what's noticeable is that there seems to be more of a consolidation between this rural and urban, in the sense that if you look at the map, you've got these two seaboards, but then you've got the whole range, the Mideast, the Great Plains, the South, that are actually Republican. And it does seem to me that what this election could do, it's so polarized, is actually to consolidate. Not that you have two Americas, but you do have a Republican Party that says, look, most of this territory is ours. Therefore, we're the Americans, and relegating the others. So in a sense, it's population versus territory.
There's been a debate on the fringes of American politics for a while that perhaps the Electoral College isn't the most sensible way of electing a president, and perhaps you should do it on the popular vote. And the advantage of that would also mean that not only whoever gets the most votes wins, but that candidates have to go to other places. So Republicans will have to campaign in California, Democrats will have to campaign in Wyoming. Do you think that could make more of the states purple rather than so polarized?
Well, it's possible. I mean, the reason there is an electoral college is because the founding fathers didn't trust the people. They thought of them as mobs, and so therefore they put this barrier in between. I can't see that changing. That would require, I'm afraid, a constitutional amendment. Population, that would mean that the large urban areas would almost always triumph over the sparely populated rural areas, who, of course, require representation as well. It's a bad system, but I don't see it changing in any time soon.
Kathy, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to day 3 of our US election specials here on Monocle 24. We'll be talking about the polls next.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 14:56 here in New York.
And 18:56 here in London. Before we say goodbye, a very quick polling update. We've got some of the latest data right in front of us. And Aisha, I want to just talk about some of the interesting Senate seats. We're seeing in, let's go to Indiana first, Mordock and Donnelly. Donnelly is a Democrat candidate. Richard Mordock, many people remember, is the second Republican senatorial candidate to say something stupid about rape and abortion. Donnelly is up. The Democrats are up by 3 in there. What do you make of that, Aisha? There seem to be a number of seats which the Republicans thought were going to be good for them, where their candidates appear to be blowing it.
Indeed. Well, I mean, across the board, it's looking like it's very much closely drawn, apart from seats and polls that are showing that previously the GOP thinking they had an upper hand, and now the Democrats are getting in. If we look at Florida, Romney held the advantage there, and now Obama leads by 48% to 46. I don't know if we can put that down to the weather, perhaps. Can we put it down to the fact that we're seeing Obama leading as commander-in-chief over the last few days? People are tired of partisan politics. We've been watching people debate and argue for the last few months, and now we've actually seen a leader step up and do what he needs to do.
Two other quick polls in Florida. Ben Nelson is ahead for Democrats by 6.7. And also in Massachusetts, which is quite interesting, Professor Elizabeth Warren, is beating Scott Brown, the Liberal Republican. There really is a Liberal Republican, honestly. That's it for today's show. Special thanks to our guest, Professor Kathy Burke of UCL here in London.
And to Maria Hinojosa, founder of Futura Media Group, here with me in New York. Our engineer on this side of the Atlantic was the lovely Paul Ruest here at Argo Studios. My producer was Barrett Austin, and our researcher was Pauline Eiferman.
Ben Jay was twiddling the knobs here. Kate Bilbao was the producer. We're going to be back on Monday in New York. All of us will be there. Don't forget as well, the clocks change. So it'll be 1300 hours on the East Coast. 1300 hours, 1800 hours London time. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Steve Bloomfield in London.
And me, Aisha Spears, in New York.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.